Now, no one, and I've talked to some of the world's leading researchers, no one knows what consciousness is. And when people say that machines are conscious, they're actually talking nonsense. They don't even know what consciousness is. And many leading researchers are perfectly content to simulate intelligence without consciousness. In other words, that X-ray AI machine, the result looks as if it had been reached by a conscious, intelligent human being. But it's been reached by a machine which is neither intelligent nor conscious. It's simply doing what it's been programmed to do.
Now, here's your host, Jim Rohn.
Praise God. It is another beautiful day. I thank you for tuning in to Global Radio today. Today our topic is AI. AI. AI is artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is a collection of all the information that has been put into a computer frame and system to solve complex problems that require many inputs and a lot of calculation. And some people say it's going to eliminate doctors, medicine, and even some sciences. But AI is missing one main thing, and that is consciousness. And it's lacking the consciousness of God, our Creator. It does not have a human spirit, and it does not, as I can see, recognize God's spirit or input. It is a godless system that will lead us to godless answers. God is interested in our lives, and He has been speaking to us from the beginning of time. Though man has not been listening very well, God is always speaking, and we need that part of anything that we need to solve, any equation, any problem. Without God's Spirit, we're lost. Today, we have Professor John Lennox, a professor at Oxford University, as he explores AI, a system without consciousness or God. John Lennox.
Now, you have asked me to speak on a hugely important topic, and I'm going to try my best to introduce it to you in the context of deep concern on the part of many leading thinkers. E.O. Wilson is a brilliant American entomologist, and he said that the real problem of humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology, and it's terrifically dangerous. Until we answer those huge questions of philosophy that the philosophers abandoned a couple of generations ago, where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? Rationally, we're on very thin ground. I disagree with them about the philosophers. We are fortunate, I think, in the Christian world to have some distinguished philosophers, some in this room tonight, who have not abandoned these big questions, which are the famous three questions of Immanuel Kant. We have ways of dealing with this fundamental set of problems, even though they are terrifically dangerous. And one brilliant way of formulating those answers was given by the late Lord Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. Science, he said, takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts them together to see what they mean. And tragically, the emphasis over the centuries on the natural sciences and their domination, and I'm a scientist and I love science, has, as the recent writer, neuroscientist, polymath Ian McGilchrist has said, it's left us in a world where we understand how almost everything works, and we know the meaning of nothing. And so he's written a book called The Matter with Things. But what are these scary things? Well, they're not just the product of overheated imagination of science fiction writers. They are coming from some of the most distinguished minds in our generation, like, for example, our astronomer royal, Lord Martin Rees. Talking about our topic, he says, the abstract thinking by biological brains has underpinned the emergence of all culture and science, but this activity, spanning tens of millennia at most, will be a brief precursor to the more powerful intellects of the inorganic post-human era. So, in the far future, it won't be the minds of humans, but those of machines, that will most fully understand the cosmos. Now, of course, we are all familiar with two famous books, dystopias written about the future, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and George Orwell's 1984. And my title, 2084, was given to me by a very famous atheist in Oxford, who, when he discovered I was writing on artificial intelligence, he said, I've got a title for you. And he said, you should call it 2084. So I said, if I do, I'll acknowledge you. And I did. Neil Postman, in a fascinating book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, wrote some time ago, contrasting these two analyses of the future. Orwell, he said, warns that we will be overcome by an externally imposed oppression, Big Brother. But in Huxley's vision, no Big Brother is required to deprive people of their autonomy, maturity, and history. People will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. So Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. And in our current culture, it seems to me that both things are happening simultaneously. We have a love-hate relationship with what is going on. Now, the response to the technologically driven oppression in terms of surveillance, reactions are very different. Some people think, and here's an example, a very famous web engine developer, and he said that AI doesn't mean that the end of humanity is nigh. It's maths, code, computers, built by people, owned by people, controlled by people. The idea that it will, at some point, develop a mind of its own and decide that it has motivations that lead it to try to kill us is a superstition, a superstitious hand wave. In short, AI doesn't want, it doesn't have goals, it doesn't want to kill you because it's not alive. AI is a machine, and it's not going to come alive any more than your toaster. Mind you, when my toaster this morning threw two bits of toast up 2 feet in the air, I thought maybe it was coming alive. So that's one view. But here's a different view by a man who's known as the godfather of AI, Jeffrey Hinton, who left Google recently to be free to speak about what he saw as the dangers of it. So here's what he says, but as soon as it gets really complicated, we don't actually know what's going on any more than we know what's going on in your brain. We designed the learning algorithm. But when this learning algorithm then interacts with data, it produces complicated neural networks that are good at doing things. But we don't, here it comes for the second time, we don't really understand exactly how they do those things. One of the ways in which these systems might escape control is by writing their own computer code to modify themselves. And that's something we need to seriously worry about. So that puts forward a picture, some of it optimistic, some of it pessimistic, of the future. But what are we talking about? We're talking about artificial intelligence. But what is it? And it comes in two sorts, as many of you will know. There's narrow AI, and a narrow AI system typically does one thing and one thing only that normally requires an intelligent human being. Radiology gives us a very good example. An AI system for analyzing chest X-ray images uses an algorithm. That's just simply a set of step-by-step instructions embedded in computer software that selects a fit for my X-ray of my lungs from a huge database of X-rays of other people that are labeled by doctors with the diseases that they represent. And it then gives the diagnosis. And that diagnosis these days will normally be better than what your local hospital can give you. There's been a recent phenomenal development in adaptive radiotherapy for tumors. Artificial intelligence reduces 2 weeks' work to 5 minutes. And that kind of advance is spectacularly beneficial to human beings. Now, what we're going to find is this, that like any technology, AI is like a sharp knife. A sharp knife can be used to do surgery. It can be used to commit murder. And the more advanced the technology, the more it can be used for good and the more it can be used for evil. So let's just have a look, run through briefly some current examples of narrow AI. Digital assistants, Siri, Alexa, and so on. Online shopping. I buy a book. A few minutes later, a pop-up tells me that people who bought my book often bought the other book. Then there's the phenomenal research conducted by people like Dimas Hassabis, one of the geniuses of the AI world, who solved a problem that was thought to be completely intractable, and that is, how do proteins fold? And to make new molecules and to use them for the development of medicine and so on. Then AI is used for job interviews or non-interviews, where people never come face-to-face with an individual, but an artificial intelligence poses questions to them and decides whether they're suitable for the job. And of course, now the dangers start, because bias is built in. The programs are made by humans, and humans are biased. And some of these interviewing programs have been seen to be biased against women, for example, against people of color, and so on and so forth. And there's a whole industry out there trying to deal with the increasingly intransigent problem of the ethics of artificial intelligence. Because the one thing that's obvious is this: the technology is rising at a vast pace, and the ethics is chugging along very far behind. Then there's crime prevention. And this brings me again to the kind of face recognition technology, which is incredibly sophisticated. It's no longer face recognition. The Chinese have developed cameras that can recognize you by your gait from any direction, the back, the front, anything. And of course, police forces love to have this to pick out a terrorist in the crowd. But the flip side of it is there's an entire population in Xinjiang in China that is being monitored unbelievably and is being oppressed and suppressed by being subject to the most intrusive and constant surveillance. And now comes the huge problem. You want to be secure. We all want to be secure. How much of your privacy are you prepared to give up to be secure? And that's a very difficult problem to decide. So these technologies are being used, particularly in Xinjiang, to control a population and, in fact, to remove its ethnic roots and re-educate it. But as a famous article in this warned, all the technology that can do this is available in the West. And the writer pointed out the only difference is it is not yet in the West under the control of a single authoritarian central authority. Then we've got ChatGPT. Now, these are all just narrow AI. All of this stuff is working. It's in operation today. ChatGPT, as you know, is a very advanced version of the thing that used to drive me mad. My first simple, smart-ish phone kept telling me what I should write next. Do you remember those phones? And they drove you absolutely out of your mind. But now ChatGPT, you can write into it and type a question and ask it, what does Mark Lanier think of atheism? And it's read all his books, but it didn't get permission from you for copyright, did it? And as many of you know, there's a big class action being undertaken. It's read my books, I checked that up, some of them. It has given up, I think. So there are all those problems. And it's interesting because it's useful. I know many people that are using it to do research, to find out things, to have stuff to investigate. But all of them tell me it is very important to check out what you find. Very interesting thing recently, ChatGPT was asked a series of very penetrating questions. Are you an atheist? And after a whole sequence of questions, it came to the end and it says, I'm an atheist. But the next question was, are you a Christian? And these penetrating questions went all the way through, and it ended up by saying, you may say, I am a Christian. So it's both a Christian and an atheist at the same time, apparently. There are huge dangers with this, and there's a very big debate among school teachers. I was in a seminar for directors of higher educational institutions. Half of them wanted it used, half of them wanted it banned. And people are working, and I know in this country especially, as to how far you can let it go. Should we have all examinations in Faraday cages so that there's no electronic signal can come in or out? I tend to agree with that kind of approach to it. We need to test what people think. Then there are deep fakes, and this is now getting into really serious territory. A short video clip of you, a short audio clip, and they can make you say anything they want you to say. And the deepfake technology is already to such an extent that you might get a phone call. I wonder if any of you have. It sounds like your daughter, and she's stuck in Paris, and she needs an air ticket, and it's on sale right at the moment. And please, Dad, send me $1,000 at once. What father who had $1,000 would reject that? But it's not his daughter. It's a clone of the voice by a deep fake, and it could be on video. So many families are adopting the very sensible technique that if any putative family member telephones them to talk about finance, they've got code words and code questions so that they can be sure they're talking to their children. And then there are, of course, autonomous vehicles, autonomous weapons. AI war is already being fought by the control of swarms of drones that are equipped with lethal weapons. So that raises all kinds of questions. So all of these are technologies that are being developed at a huge speed, and they're all in operation today. But artificial intelligence is not intelligent. The word artificial is there for a reason. It simulates intelligence. In other words, it plays what's called the imitation game, which is the name of a very interesting film about the late Alan Turing, who invented the who solved the problem of the German Enigma machine and invented the bomb, B-O-M-B-E. And it's important to realize, and we're coming closer to a very big question, what is a human being? Because that's being questioned left, right, and center today. We notice that God has coupled in human beings intelligence with consciousness. Now, no one, and I've talked to some of the world's leading researchers, no one knows what consciousness is. And when people say that machines are conscious, they're actually talking nonsense. They don't even know what consciousness is. And many leading researchers are perfectly content to simulate intelligence without consciousness. In other words, that X-ray AI machine, the result looks as if it had been reached by a conscious, intelligent human being. But it's been reached by a machine which is neither intelligent nor conscious. It's simply doing what it's been programmed to do. And here Stuart Russell and Peter Norvig, authors of what's regarded by many people as the AI Bible, Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, third edition, we are interested in creating programs that behave intelligently. The additional project of making them conscious is not one that we are equipped to take on, nor one whose success we would be able to determine. That's a very honest statement by two of the pioneers in these fields. All of that, narrow AI, one thing that normally requires an intelligent human. But there's a second quest, and that's the quest for artificial general intelligence. And as the name suggests, the idea is to create technology that can simulate everything and a great deal more that normally takes an intelligent human being. And there are two directions of research. In order to build a super intelligent AI system that equals or exceeds all human capacities, you either take existing humans and enhance them by bioengineering, or you start with a non-biological base. One of the problems of getting old is that our bodies, the bits start to fall off it, as I know, and the bones start to creak, and all of that. Wouldn't it be great to do without the biological stuff and just have the hard silicon mechanical stuff? Well, that's one way people want to go. Now, because it is futuristic and it appeals to the imagination, there is a lot of literature about it. And in my book, I interact with various kinds of literature at a scientific and popular level, as well as the literature in the subject itself. But one of the most influential writers these days is Yuval Noah Harari. He's not a scientist. He is an Israeli historian. And he's written a book, A Brief History of Tomorrow, Homo Deus, which, being translated from Latin, is the God-man, the man who is God. And the reason he's called his book that is he believes that this century, the 21st century, is going to see two major developments. First of all, there's going to be a serious bid for immortality, by which he means we are going to solve the medical problem of physical death. For him, death is a technological problem. And he writes that technological problems always have technological solutions. So we shall solve the problem of physical death, which won't mean that people may not die. It will mean they don't have to die. And so you have people hoping that this will be solved, freezing their brains and their bodies, and hoping that one day they'll be wakened up if nobody switches the power off in the meantime that's keeping them cold. The second agenda item is intensification of the pursuit of happiness, making us happier people. Now, here's what needs to be done, according to Harari. It will be necessary to change our biochemistry and re-engineer our bodies and our minds, so that we shall need to re-engineer Homo sapiens so that it can enjoy everlasting pleasure. Now listen to this very carefully. Having raised humanity above the beastly level of survival struggles, we will now aim to upgrade humans into gods and turn Homo sapiens into Homo Deus. And he adds, now humankind is poised to replace natural selection with intelligent design and extend life from the organic realm into the inorganic. He's got many people on his side. There's a lot of money being put into it. And I would repeat, this is not simply the pipe dream of an obscure historian. There are many leading scientists like Lord Rees that feel that this will be achieved. Now, moving humankind beyond human means that they're going to become what's called transhuman. Now, that's a serious issue. God created human beings, model 101, in his own image. Now, says Harari, that's only one stage. It parallels in our society what's going on with gender. God created male and female. But now we're moving on from that. And it's all becoming fluid. Exactly the same at a much higher level is happening with human beings themselves. So what is transhumanism? A lot of it comes from my own university, I regret to say. The intellectual, and this is Nick Bostrom of the Oxford Institute for the Future, the intellectual and cultural movement that affirms the possibility and desirability of fundamentally improving the human condition through applied reason, especially by developing and making widely available technologies to eliminate aging and to greatly enhance human intellectual, physical, and psychological capacities. That's transhumanism. So we're going to enhance human beings, we're going to eliminate aging, and we're going to become essentially supermen and women, with bigger brains, more ability, and all the rest of it. But now there's been a subtle change. Transhumanism will produce, in some people's opinion, billions of entities. Let's not call them human, because they won't be human. They'll be transhuman. They may be cyborgs. A cyborg is a combination of the biological and the mechanical in many science fiction novels. And in the future, Lord Rees says that the majority of the population is going to be those entities. So what should our attitude be today? And here we come to the fearful term, and I say that advisedly, of long-termism. Listen carefully to Bostrom's priorities. Priority number 1, 2, 3, and 4 should be to reduce existential risk. We mustn't fritter away our finite resources on feel-good projects of suboptimal efficacy, such as alleviating global poverty and reducing animal suffering, since neither threatens our long-term potential, and our long-term potential is what really matters. That's devastating. Because it's a complete denial of the fundamental altruistic moral principle, love your neighbor as yourself. Don't bother about the two-thirds world, but pour your money into the brains in the West who are going to be able to develop these beings, because if you don't pour the money there, you run the risk of these beings never being created. Now, apparently, and I have this from several good sources, it's not millions but billions of dollars that are going into these projects. We've got to think very hard, ladies and gentlemen, don't we, as to how we're going to respond to this, because this is totally not amoral, but immoral. And Joshua Bendigo, who is a very famous fellow of the Royal Society, Canadian computer scientist, neural networks, deep learning. He was right in at the heart of it. And he says this, people need to understand that current AI and the AI we can foresee in the reasonable future does not and will not have a moral sense or moral understanding of what is right and what is wrong.
Thank you for listening to our program today. Global Air Force is here to bring God's love, help, and power into your life.